Hi there, we are James and Dan, two-fourths of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Each week we get around the microphones with our four favourite facts that we've learned over the last 7 days and sit down to blow each other's minds.
Yeah, here's a fact for you, Dan.
Yep.
In knot theory, a circle of rope without a knot is technically a knot, but it's called a knot.
Very good. I go on here as well. In 2019, a marathon runner with the words Jesus Saves written on his bib had a heart attack, but was revived by a man called Jesus.
That is amazing. If you want to hear more facts like that, search for No Such Thing as a Fish wherever you get your podcasts.
Woad, Boudicca, and a thorn in the side of the Romans? That's what instantly springs to mind for me when I think about the Celts.
But was Celtic society really how it's been described in school history textbooks or on films for years? We've got everything you could ever want to know about the real Celts on today's Time Team podcast.
And hello from Helen Geek and Martin Williams. Now, before we get going, I have to tell you about next week's podcast because it is very exciting. We are going to be on the road, bringing you the podcast from the side of a trench in Brancaster as we excavate the Roman fort of Branadunum, following some very exciting geophysics results from John Gator that you might have seen in a recent Time Team film. Time Team is getting its hands dirty to discover more about this remarkable site. So we will be bringing you a flavour of all of that action next week, and we are looking forward to it.
Yes, we are certainly excited about that. But Martin, I have to tell you, I've been looking forward to this episode too, because it's a real deep dive into a concept I've been interested in for years, but still I really don't know enough about. I think I've told you, Martin, several times that one of the things that I'm most interested in archaeology is what we choose to study, what it tells us about ourselves, as much as about what happened in the past. So I'm always interested in work on popular concepts in the past. And this one, the Celts, could hardly be more popular. I mean, everybody loves the Celts. Everybody wants to be Celtic. They've got beautiful art. They've got romantic saints. They've got their craggy landscapes. They've got leprechauns and pukka and fairies and that kind of intangible cool. But how have our ideas about Celts changed over the centuries? What do they say about us? What do they say about us now? What did they say about us 50 years ago, 100 years ago? This is what I love about archaeology and the study of the past, what it tells us about us.
Well, the person who's going to be helping us answer that very question and is going to be guiding us through this fascinating subject for the whole of this podcast is John Waddell, former professor of archaeology at the University of Galway and author of The Celtic World, A History. Welcome, John. Lovely to speak to you.
Thank you, Martin. Great to be here.
Yes, it's lovely to have you here, John. Thank you very much for joining us. Now, tell us about the Celts. Why are you interested in them? What is it about their society and how we think about them that fascinates you?
Well, it's a complicated story because I suppose hundreds, maybe even thousands of books have been written about the Celts. There have been books on Celtic archaeology, Celtic mythology, Celtic art, as you mentioned. And one could wonder why another. Well, I started this book because of one particular problem. Many of these books, if not most of them, that I've read at least, have focused on archaeology or art or mythology, as I said. And yet for me, and for many people who have worked in the field, a Celt was not a Boudicca or a tall, ferocious warrior, or indeed a fairy poet or a leprechaun or anything like that. A Celt was, in ancient times, was first and foremost somebody who spoke a Celtic language. Now, many people have argued over these definitions, the definitions that embraced race and heaven knows what else. But as I said, a Celt was first and foremost a Celtic speaker. And when you look at the evidence, Celtic languages were spoken from the west of Ireland right across Europe to Galatia in Turkey in pre-Roman times. It's a remarkable phenomenon. And I thought I would try and address the story of the discovery of the Celts, both from an archaeological and a language perspective. In other words, to try and bring the language and the archaeology together. Now, I'm no expert in Celtic studies. This is the term that's generally given for those who work in the ancient languages of the ancient Celts. But I tried, I think, to bring the story of the discovery of the two in tandem over the last few centuries, because the story of the discovery of the Celts, that might have been an even better title for the book, the story of the discovery of the Celts takes us to all of these areas, from lunatic theories of the past, racial theories of the 19th century, up to some brilliant work in the 20th century and indeed in the new millennium.
Well, let's start at the beginning, shall we, and really explore some of what you were talking about there. What sort of time period are we talking about when we think about the Celts?
Well, I think many of the books that have been written on the Celts do touch on their early history. And that is a history that is basically first recorded in Greek and Roman writings. And that is when the Celts first come to prominence. So we're talking really about the last few centuries before Christ, the end of prehistory, just before the rise of the Roman Empire. That was, I suppose, the heyday of Celtic Europe, because eventually the Celts in most of Europe were overcome by the rising power of the Roman Empire, and they gradually faded from the scene, only to survive in remote and desolate areas like Scotland, Ireland, and Wales.
Well, you know, I think I'm a bit of what you call in the book a Celto-skeptic, because I'm of the age where I was really influenced by those studies of the 1990s that suggested that Celticness was a kind of romantic invention of the 18th century. So I wanted to ask you about this. Now, do you think that those various Celtic tribes or nations or societies, or whatever you want to call them, did they really have anything in common apart from the language?
That is, in fact, the question. And I mean, the Celtic skepticism that surfaced mainly in England in the 1990s was in part justified. People were looking more critically at the ancient Celtic world. Because as we all know, the Celts, particularly in Ireland and to a lesser extent in Scotland, but certainly Ireland and Wales, assumed a very romantic aura and became, if you like, romanticized, possibly exaggerated, and certainly perhaps overdone in some ways. But that was part of, at least in Ireland, the rise of nationalism. The Celts became, if you like, almost a national symbol in the 19th and early 20th century in Ireland, and the same to a certain degree in France. And I suppose that coloured perceptions around Europe in some way. Celto-skepticism was also born of the fact that virtually everybody who subscribed to it, in England certainly, looked at the archaeology. And when you look at the archaeology of Europe in those pre-Roman centuries, it's absolutely true that there is great diversity across the whole of the so-called Celtic world. Settlement patterns in Ireland are different from those in Britain in many respects, and the same applies to differences on the continent. And yet, when you start to look at the similarities, you have the language, but you also possibly have good evidence for a significant degree of interconnectivity. And of course, when there was a common language family, when you think about it, when you have evidence for trade and exchange, of which there is abundance in archaeology, this also means that people travelled, myths, stories, and religious beliefs travelled. So behind the linguistic facade, I think, you do have interconnectivity, and that helps to sort of offer you a picture that is at once one of great diversity, but also one of great connections. And I think that was the problem with the Celto-skeptics from the 1990s onwards. They just didn't look at the other element, the crucial language element, which did connect people. This isn't to say there weren't huge differences across the Celtic world. Of course there were. But I think when you look at language plus archaeology, you get a more balanced picture. And that was the thing I attempted to do in the Celtic world of history.
Yes, because I suppose, in a way, it doesn't really matter whether these things are, in inverted commas, real. It doesn't really matter whether everybody's got the same descent groups. In a sense, it doesn't even really matter what the DNA is telling us about how interrelated everybody is. If you speak the same language and you're in tune with your culture, you know, today we might think of it as, say, films and music. In those days, it might have been things like art and enamelling and so on. it doesn't really matter what's lying behind that in terms of descent groups if you are of the same culture today. I mean, just at its most obvious, you have a Scottish surname, you sound Irish, and we're all talking English. We're part of the same culture, whether you live in a Celtic country and I live in a Germanic origin Kingdom of East Anglia. It's more about how you believe yourself to be than any kind of actual reality in a way.
But also, it's also about other beliefs as well. And it's all too easy to, I suppose, overlook belief systems in all of this. On the cover of the book, you will see a picture of the Corlaig Head, which is a very fine three-faced stone head from Celtic Ireland. I stuck that on the cover of the book simply because it is just one of these things that serves to remind us of shared beliefs. Because if you look at, say, some of the work of Miranda Green, for example, she points out that in continental Europe, you will find three-faced and three-headed stone figures reflecting the same religious belief, whatever it was, as the Corlaig Head in eastern France, in the area of the tribe of the Rémy. And that's just one small illustration of a belief system that actually obviously surfaces just particularly in two areas where you find three-faced heads and three-headed people, but also in certain parts of the Celtic world where they also indulge in stone carving. That's an indication of shared belief systems. And when we think about it, shared belief systems are just as powerful in their own way in connecting people as language might be, as trade and exchange might be. And that's another strand in this ancient Celtic world story that we tend to overlook. And I try to follow it as far as one can in charting the various discoveries that illuminate the Celtic world of old in this book.
So we're getting a picture then of a group of people who identify as being Celtic because of a shared language and elements of a shared culture, despite being geographically dispersed over quite a wide area, or a much wider area than I think people consider today. Can I just get you to confirm or deny some of the things that I've always associated with the Celts? In my mind, and I think the mind of a lot of people who would have seen and got this idea of Celts from school and also from films and things like that, is that they're this rabble of sort of unorganized tribes. They paint themselves blue and they go into battle with the Roman army, kind of screaming and shouting. How close to reality, or indeed how far away from reality, is that view of what a Celt is?
I think we have to blame a lot of people for that particular image. In part, I suppose the Celts did not help themselves. In attempting to defy the power of Rome, they engaged at the very dawn of history with perhaps the most powerful enemy on the planet. And of course, as we know, victors write the history. The image we have from Greek and Roman writers is one of a wild barbarian people. And that is one particular view that has, I suppose, stayed with us to the present day. It's partly true, in a sense, but when you look critically at the Roman world, I can think sometimes of a more wild and barbarian people at times. Scholars today would describe Caesar's campaign in Gaul, for example, as a genocidal enterprise. He massacred tens of thousands of people in what can only be described as a bloody campaign of extermination. Now, okay, to a certain degree, we have to admit that Rome brought a lot of good things to the Western world. But as I said, the picture that is sometimes presented today is not necessarily a true one. However, to be fair, a tribal society was not as stable, perhaps, as an empire in many ways. Tribal societies were frequently at war with one another. But when you think about it, a completely unstable society did not produce, or could not produce, because of the nature of the beast, marvellous earthworks, marvellous artwork, or indeed bequeath us an extraordinary language full of, interesting mythologies and beliefs. So while there was this disorganised and warlike element, there was also a much more settled element, which we tend to ignore. I mean, the great fortifications of the last few centuries BC in Britain, the oppida, huge, almost urban-like centres built from the Czech Republic westwards in Germany and France, and indeed in Britain, speak of a society that in some ways could be remarkably organised. And we tend to forget that. I was struck actually on a visit to the north of England a year or two ago to discover that Stanwick, the great oppidum of the Brigantes in Yorkshire, was virtually unknown to the local inhabitants. I did try and point out they all once were speaking Irish, actually more accurate, a Celtic language before Rome. But Stanich is one huge fortification that can be matched in France and Germany. And it speaks to the emergence of a highly organized society, at least that maintained a significant measure of tribal organization for several centuries before finally succumbing to the power of Rome. And that is actually one of the problems with the Celtoskeptics. Celtic Britain before Rome was a society, a landscape full of there were dozens and dozens of Celtic tribes whose names only come down to us in Roman contexts or on coins. I think it's a lost landscape in many respects in Britain. It deserves to be, I suppose, more publicized. And that was one of the things I tried to do in the book, by the way. I point out that the ancient Celts in France and Germany have had various museums and heritage centers and interpretive centers built to celebrate great discoveries. I mean, the Glauberg, for example, in Germany, celebrates them in its Celtic Museum. Some of the great finds, including a huge statue found a number of years ago. Various other sites in France, like Alesia and Bibracte, have very significant museums attached to them. There isn't a single museum or heritage center solely or principally devoted to the ancient Celts in Britain.
Hi there, we are James and Dan Twofort of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Each week we get around the microphones with our four favourite facts that we've learned over the last 7 days and sit down to blow each other's minds.
Yeah, here's a fact for you, Dan.
Yep.
In knot theory, a circle of rope without a knot is technically a knot, but it's called a knot.
Very good. I go on here as well. In 2019, a marathon runner with the words Jesus Saves written on his bib had a heart attack, but was revived by a man called Jesus.
That is amazing. If you want to hear more facts like that, search for No Such Thing as a Fish wherever you get your podcasts.
I think you're right in that very few people in England have any idea what the relevant local Iron Age tribe was called. I think in Norfolk, where I work, we're perhaps an exception in that we know we're the Iceni because we've got Boudicca. And maybe in Yorkshire, they know they're the Brigantes because they've got Cartimandua. You have these wonderful personalities. But I think it's quite rare to know, for somebody to know the boundary between the Trinovantes and the Catavellauni or whatever. And I'm not totally sure I even know the other Oppida. Are we thinking of places that are now Colchester and St Albans?
Yes, these are places that in pre-Roman times probably had a very large tribal settlement. And you mentioned the Iceni, for example, in Norfolk. As I think many people in Britain probably know, the lands at Snettisham there have produced the largest quantity of Celtic torques in gold and silver found anywhere in Europe. And I make the point in the book that the Iceni, and not just Boudicca, the Iceni themselves do deserve a memorial in Norfolk, you know, because those lands there at Snettisham must have been one of the greatest ritual centres in the Western Celtic world in their day. To have all that gold deposited there over time. Hoard after hoard of gold has been found there over many years and well published by the British Museum.
But we seem to have a problem in interpreting them. We seem to have a problem in telling the stories. Sometimes I find myself thinking, well, we almost shoot ourselves in the foot because so far we've been talking for a while and no one's mentioned the Druids, who surely must be one of the most exciting and evocative images of the Celtic world. Are the Druids something that we should bother about? Or should we just say, oh, well, it's impossible to tell who they were. It's all lost in the mists of time and we should not bother. And what's your view, John, on the Druids?
Well, the Druids have had a long life in Britain. They've been a very popular topic for the best part of several centuries. And it all started, of course, many centuries ago when Stonehenge was attributed to Celtic Druids. And they took off and have been living happily in various parts of Britain, notably Wales, ever since. They're not quite so popular in Ireland. I don't quite know why. But they have been popular on the continent as well. The truth of the matter is, we know a certain amount about the continental Druids from classical sources. We know precious little about them from native Irish and Welsh sources. And that's a problem because much of this literature, medieval literature, contains a mixture of, I suppose, Christian invention, Christian negativity and some very ancient things about the Druids. But when you drill into it all, we actually do know rather little about the Druids. They were hugely important in Celtic society because they were the possessors of tribal knowledge, the passers on of great tales and genealogies. They are a bit of a mystery, and I think they will probably remain so, because to identify them in the archaeological record has proven to be extremely difficult. But they remain a particular fascination, possibly because they are such a hazy, I was going to say figment of the imagination, but no, they're not a figment of the imagination. They were.
They were real.
We all love a mystery, don't we?
Oh, we do. We do.
Yes, I think they are. This is what makes them so interesting in many respects.
You mentioned the Druids. We've talked about the Iceni. We're talking about these different pockets, these different groups of Celtic societies. How much communication would there have been between these groups to form one cohesive Celtic society, if that was a thing?
Well, that is a very interesting question, because archaeology, as you know, has vacillated over the years. A few decades ago, and certainly a century ago, invasions were the popular explanation for cultural change. And you had various population groups, including Celts, sweeping around various parts of Europe. Things became a little calmer in the 20th century. People looked more at trade and exchange. And when you look at the archaeological record critically, there is at certain times abundant evidence for contact between groups of people. And of course, today, genetic studies have now brought us back, if you like, not quite to square one, but have suddenly demonstrated a considerable degree of movement in prehistory that people were simply unaware of. And I'm very excited by this, because I'm quite confident that in the years and decades to come, genetic studies will radically alter the picture we have of prehistoric Europe in many ways, and will demonstrate a considerable degree of mobility between peoples. And when you think of what mobility means, it means the exchange of goods and people, fosterage, children being sent to live in neighbouring families, intermarriage, particularly at an elite level, and of course, a degree of migration as well. And all of this figured in the past to a considerable degree. And I think we'll be coming to terms with that complicated picture in a better way in the years to come.
For somebody like me, who has grown up with the idea that migration is a figment of the imagination and that it's all to do with power, the language that you speak in places, particularly like Cornwall and Ireland and so on, the language you speak is the language of the of those in power, and it's not to do with people moving. It's really difficult for us to take those the previous ideas, the ideas that we were railing against, and say, actually, they had a point. We now can see from the DNA that there is a point. We need to have some kind of middle way that accepts all of these ideas, that language, particularly a widespread language, is often imposed upon people by the records they have to keep and the language in which they have to speak to authority. But that doesn't mean that people didn't move around as well to a certain extent. I think these huge waves of migration that happened in the aftermath of the Roman Empire, where entire groups of people are moving around Europe, that I still find really hard to believe is happening into the uplands of North and West Britain. But I've got to come to terms with it in some ways. I've really got to, because the DNA, we may not know how to interpret it at the moment, but the DNA doesn't lie. We've got to find a way of meshing that into all our other theories and bring all of the evidence to bear.
In particular, Helen, yes, the study of ancient DNA. I know the study of modern DNA gives a sort of a picture of the complications of the past, but it's when you get down to the ancient skeleton remains and start examining them, that's where the true picture of a mobility such as it is comes into focus, I think. And one of the interesting things in writing this book was to actually chart the changing views of people over the centuries about the Celts. You know, one of the criticisms of the Celtic world by those who had doubts about it was that people in Ireland and in Britain never called themselves Celts in the past. Indeed, one English archaeologist said that nobody ever called themselves a Celt. But that, of course, is not true, because Caesar in his Gallic Wars talks of people in Gaul calling themselves Celtic. So, I mean, at least a few groups did call themselves Celts. But the reason, in fact, why the Celtic label was never used was that actually in Christian times, there was only one authority that you had to follow, and that was the Bible. And the Bible told you very firmly that Japhet, the son of Noah, was the father of all the peoples of Europe. And if you're like, everybody then began to conjure up origin myths that did not include the Celts, but always brought them back to good old Japhet, far to the east. In Ireland, the Milesians who came here allegedly from Scythia via Spain were the sons of Japhet. Medieval Britons saw their ancestors in Troy, a very glorious ancestry. The Franks did the same. They sought a glorious ancestry in the east, ultimately all going back to that bloody son of Noah. So the irrefutable nature of biblical authority obscured, if you like, any historical sense there may have been, because you simply had to follow what was the obvious source of all knowledge, the Bible. And it was only in the 16th and then 17th centuries that people began to explore the relationship between the various languages, Irish, Welsh, Cornish, Breton, and began to think up another picture. And that's when the Celts came into focus again. But they were absent from the scene for many, many centuries, thanks to Japhet and the rest of them.
Yes, and the another extraordinary thing is that the Anglo-Saxons could, and early medieval peoples throughout Britain, could believe in this history from Brutus in Troy, but they could also at the same time believe that they were descended from Anglo-Saxons and Jutes, and they didn't see a cognitive dissonance there, that was just, we believe in this sometimes and we also believe in that. And just as you have two parents, maybe you have multiple sources, and we choose one to foreground when it's necessary and the other one at other times. We always have this belief that people must have had a consistent and logical idea in the past, even though we are not consistent and logical. And everything is complicated. And when people point out inconsistencies, you say, oh, yes, you're right, I hadn't thought of that. But those inconsistent ideas have been jostling in your head all your life. And somehow we have a double standard. It's okay for us to be illogical, but people in the past, no, they must have conformed to the patterns we impose upon them.
Well, I think history was fluid. People had various myths that offered them comfort, and indeed, from time to time, a very sensible vision of the world, you know. Today, of course, we like to think we are very enlightened, but I still think of, was it Groucho Marx who said, I have principles, and if you don't like them, I have others, you know, or words to that effect. In other words, I think people were pretty flexible as well when it came to beliefs. But beliefs, well, mythical beliefs were extremely important. They anchored people, both in the past and in the present.
And the really difficult thing about archaeology is how impossible it is to get back to those mythical beliefs. We know that they're important. We know that people's contradictory and complicated beliefs are what makes them into their societies and the units that we can study. And yet we find it so difficult to reconstruct those from archaeological evidence. And you can think, well, there's something behind it. But we don't have the theoretical frameworks that allow us to use that information in any practical way. And that I suppose, is the central kind of tragedy, if you like, of prehistoric archaeology, that there are some things that are absolutely lost.
You're now touching on one of my favourite themes because, as you rightly say, accessing the belief systems of prehistoric people, quite frankly, is impossible. Without a written record, we simply don't know what people believed. But I have a feeling that we do a disservice to the past if we don't try and explore what beliefs may have been in the past. Now, it's dangerous ground, I mean, but I think informed speculation is something that can add something to the archaeological scenario. I don't believe it should supplant rational inquiry, but I think if we don't attempt at least to offer some suggestions about past beliefs, we are leaving only a partial picture of the past. I can think of one very interesting illustration of this. It's not anything to do with the Celts. A series of bones from an Irish tomb of Neolithic date were discovered many, many years ago. I think they ended up in Cambridge in England. But they were eventually re-examined, and somebody discovered that, in fact, these bones that were just casually collected when the tomb was investigated in the early 20th century had cut marks on them made with a flint implement. Now, we all know that in Neolithic times, a lot of people were exposed in the sense that their corpses were left out to disintegrate, and then the disarticulated bones were placed in the grave or in the tomb. But in this case, in this one case where this piece of interesting analysis was done, the cut marks demonstrated that some skeletons had been deliberately defleshed before being placed in a dried condition in the tomb. And if you think about it, this defleshing was a hideously complicated process because the various cut marks suggested they had a detailed knowledge, whoever did it, of how to disassemble and disentangle a corpse. And the corpse had to be, you know, disemboweled and its cranium removed, no doubt, and all sorts of other things. But it reminded me of an ancient Indo-European myth in which the bones of the first man were used to create mountains. His hair was used for some other parts of the landscape. You know, there's a mythical story about a disintegrated human being creating the world, in fact. And that reminded me, I mean, rather like the Christian Eucharist, this was a mythic theme that was used to explain the past. And I thought that perhaps behind this very peculiar ritual in Neolithic Ireland, there was some sort of cosmological belief. And it's just worth noting the fact that it may have been an illustration of something very complicated, very religious, and very deep going on. This just wasn't a bit of, you know, butchery outside a tomb in the Neolithic. It was a very religious and significant process being done there. And that's where I think a little bit of speculation, dare I say it, adds flesh to the bones of prehistory.
Absolutely. And returning to my theme, it tells us just as much about us with what interpretation we put on it as perhaps it does about the past. But that's no reason not to do it. Thank you so much, John. It's been an absolute treat talking to you because you've encapsulated so many things that I barely think about. They just occasionally trouble my grey matter and pass off almost immediately. But you've put them so well and so beautifully that...
Fools rush in, Helen, I think.
No, these are important things.
They are important things. I thought we might end by returning to my theme, I feel, of this discussion, which has been the kind of misconceptions that people have about the Celts and trying to right a few wrongs. And I just wonder, John, if you had, you know, the one myth, if you could just dispel one myth that people have, what would it be? Sort of, I suppose, in other words, what's the most important thing in your mind that people understand about the Celts and Celtic society that they maybe don't at the moment?
That is a horrifying question to answer. I mean, because it's extremely complicated. I suppose several myths about the modern Celts were introduced in the 19th century. Matthew Arnold, for example, suggested that the Celts were frivolous people who had a love of bright colours and were emotional. This was in complete contrast, you understand, to the sturdy Anglo-Saxons of Germanic origin. So I suppose these racial residual notions of how different people are should be quietly disposed of. I don't think when it comes to language and literature today, there's any difference between a descendant of a Celt and a descendant of an Anglo-Saxon, you know. But sometimes the notion that Celts are a little frivolous or unreliable, more prone to put on leprechaun hats, dare I say, than others, you know. Maybe modern Celts do not help themselves in perpetuating a certain image. However, it's all right on the rugby field, I think, to wear a green whatnot or something, you know. But I mean, it shouldn't blur us about how interesting the Celtic past was and how it has shaped the present in many ways, not necessarily with leprechauns and fairies, but in many other ways as well. I mean, the Celtic past has left us an extraordinary legacy, particularly, for example, in myth and legend and in the artistic world, as we've mentioned as well, you know, and that's worth looking at more closely.
Well, it's all worth looking at more closely, I think. And as Helen says, a really, really interesting and thought-provoking conversation that we've had. So, John, thank you very, very much indeed for coming on the podcast to talk about it all.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much, John. And don't forget, The Celtic World, A History by John Waddell is available now.
Yes, it is. And well, that is it from us this week. We hope you found it, well, very, very interesting. Proper deep dive, wasn't it? Next week is going to be complete chaos, I think, because we're bringing you the podcast from the side of a trench in a field in Brancaster. We cannot wait for that.
No, neither can I. But until then, have a lovely rest of your week and we'll speak to you on the next Time Team podcast.
Hi there, we are James and Dan Twofort of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Each week we get around the microphones with our four favourite facts that we've learned over the last 7 days and sit down to blow each other's minds.
Yeah, here's a fact for you, Dan.
Yep.
In knot theory, a circle of rope without a knot is technically a knot, but it's called a knot knot.
Very good. I go on here as well. In 2019, a marathon runner with the words Jesus Saves written on his bib had a heart attack, but was revived by a man called Jesus.
That is amazing. If you want to hear more facts like that, search for No Such Thing as a Fish wherever you get your podcasts.